And
we're back.
We are. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
And this is This Week on Channel 9.
So we got a full show.
We do.
Lots of stuff going on.
We do.
And should we just get into it?
Let's just get right into it.
All right. So first story, Kinect SDK Beta 1 refresh.
That's right. So you interviewed Rob Relier. Is that how we're saying it now? Rob Relier, I believe. We always call him Rob Relia, and you got schooled on that.
Yes, I did, actually, as a matter of fact. So that's not the story, but...
Well, the story is that they released a refresh of the Kinect SDK, but you already said that. So,
absolutely. And yeah. A lot of things that people are going to be interested in here. Mm-hmm. One is bug fixes and, you know, even driver issues. So there were some issues, like, with a machine coming out of sleep where the driver would crash. We fixed those. Then some other stuff around removing APIs that didn't even work. They were there, but they didn't actually do anything.
They were just, like, stubbed?
Yeah, exactly. So remove those for clarity, and it's not that they won't be coming back. It's just, you know, to sort of clarify what does and doesn't work. And then some different implementation details. One is the skeleton frame-ready event. So I think I gave you this story, but the short answer is skeleton frame-ready is you sign up for an event, mm-hmm. you tell the skeleton engine, hey, you know what, I want to know when there's a skeleton. I initialize the Kinect SDK, and I want to say, I'm going to use skeletal tracking. Mm-hmm. Then I sign up for an event. And what this will happen is this event will fire whenever there's a skeleton that is set to is tracked. Mm. The behavior's been changed, but the way it used to work is it would only fire that event when it was is tracked. Now it just fires all the time. So that way you don't have to worry about dealing with a situation where all of a sudden you lose a skeleton.
Mm. Skeletor is going to be really stoked about this, yeah.
The crazy part, of course, is when you're debugging, one thing you should keep in mind, and I have to tell this story, is I was working late at night.
As you do.
Yes. In Building 24, it was like a Friday. There was nobody there. It's like 10 p.m. It's completely... It's one of those things where I just let the light switch go, too, so it's completely dark in my room, too, because they start turning the light switch off. And I'm debugging this application.
It's the... You work in the office where those 12 developers were killed by a fire, like, 6 years ago, which is crazy. Yeah.
And the point is, I added a break point because I was trying to see what was going on with my skeleton and how my player ID had changed. And what I saw was that there were... and you hear these ghost stories about Kinect, where the Kinect was able to pick up some weird ghost and the ghost was moving. So I look, and it shows there's six skeletons in the room with
That's
me.
That's crazy.
So that was very frightening, but it turns out the API is designed to always return what are called player proposals, which is here's where I think six things are. And even if they're all set to zero, so no matter what, it's going to return six, right? And the reason why the skeleton frame ready thing is important is, say, for example, we're building an application where, based on the person's position, they're driving a car, like the Jelly Bean or something. If somebody falls out of that and the last position, you know, is set to, like, drive, you want to be able to know whether they've been removed or not. Mm. And the problem was before is you'd get frame ready so long as you got a skeleton. If you didn't get a skeleton, well, boom.
Because you rely on the low-level Kinect drivers to provide that to the .NET wrappers. Is that why?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same way on the C++ side. But now the frame ready will always fire, even so that way you can say, have I lost a skeleton or not? Or if you can do a link query on those six and say, are any of these actually tracked?
Right.
And tracked is how you know it's a real skeleton.
Right.
And if it's no, you can say, like, stop the Jelly Bean from driving over the cliff.
Okay.
So that's a long-winded way of explaining how skeleton frame ready will always fire now.
So Rob Relier.
Yes.
Got
Yay.
It. That's my takeaway.
Yay. Okay. Awesome. So our next story here is .NET Gadgeteer.
Go Gadgeteer. Yeah.
Yes.
So this is another way that you can build some really fun hobbyist projects without really having to be Clint Ruckus, shall we say. Someone who really, like, geeks out and understands what the difference is between input number 3 and output number 6, right?
Absolutely. So you get the board, and they include one that has a bunch of, I think it's called the GHI Fez Spider Starter Kit, and includes a bunch of different connectors. So things like Wi-Fi, things like reading an SD card, things like a camera.
Right.
So you want to build the webcam app. You're writing in .NET Micro framework, and then you can send it, say, to the web and have it, you know, work with Twitter or, yep. or whatever cool application is without having to, you know, do Arduino shields, yeah. soldering, all that kind of crazy stuff.
So on the spectrum of like writing inline assembler and like writing Lego Mindstorms code, it's closer to the Mindstorms.
Yeah, it's like for software developers that aren't hardware folks, this gives them a way to work with portable hardware.
Cool.
So that's one of the reasons why.
And I like their sample projects here. We've got arcade console, flipbook manager, maker. So, yeah, it's cool stuff.
Yeah, and I can guarantee there'll be a lot more, too. So.
Oh, you're going to guarantee. You've heard it here from
yes.
Ben Fernandez.
Yes, I suspect there's going to be more than two projects. Yes.
You suspect or you guarantee?
I guarantee.
Okay.
I don't know why you didn't go into
legal.
Why
do we work together? Yeah.
I wouldn't call this work. Windows Azure Storage Analytics.
Waza. Yeah. So so today it's really hard to get your analytics about what's going on within your Windows Azure account. And so this is a new feature available today that allows you to do exactly that for Windows Azure Storage.
And it gives you both those logs and metrics.
Right. So when was this file accessed, or metrics of how often was this file accessed?
Yeah, so hourly basis for the logs. You'll know if something, you know, did it actually go? Was there a network error? Did mm-hmm. it actually receive? How long did it take? And all that jazz.
Yep.
So lots of detailed stuff and lots of APIs to be able to play with this and build higher level analytic applications. So you can
right.
basically really get a granular control over what's going on in your Azure app.
Yep.
So very cool, which brings us to another Azure story.
Yeah, Azure Tools for Visual Studio 2010. So this is the August 2011 release of the Windows Azure Tools. So I think the last release we had was if I'm not mistaken, November of last year. No, actually, there was one in April or May this year. But another refresh. So this is the ability to support MVC3 web
sure.
roles. So
sure.
that's really cool. Managing multiple service configuration files in one cloud project. And actually, the biggest one we should mention is the ability to profile your applications on
yeah.
Windows Azure and really understand from a performance level exactly where the bottlenecks are.
So this is definitely cool and probably a must-have download for
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
For folks playing with Azure. So
yeah.
cool stuff, and kudos to the team. Smooth streaming on
yeah.
Windows Phone.
Yeah, so smooth streaming is one of those really cool features of IIS, but it can be hard to get everything enabled and configured exactly unless you've got the cookbook. And so now here's the cookbook that tells you exactly how to enable this for Windows Phone 7. So how do you set it up on IIS with the correct profile, and then how do you build an app on Windows Phone 7 so that you can do smooth streaming right down to the device?
Yeah, and even down to the how do you encode the video
mm-hmm.
so that it can play on the device.
Right, exactly. So you've got multiple, one of the advantages of smooth streaming, of course, you've got multiple bit rates so that if you're in a high bandwidth situation, you get the high quality. If you're in your low bandwidth, it's not going to stagger and buffer, and exactly what we're using on Channel 9, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So you guys going to support this? Do you know?
Yeah, there are, we need a Channel 9 app.
Oh, okay. Got it.
To be able to do that.
Well, there's a few Channel 9 apps out there, but you would ship a new one, is what you're saying, if you were going to support this.
Yeah, I don't think they're using...
I guarantee that Duncan will be building this by the end of the weekend.
That is wonderful. He's on vacation, but we'll call him back
by the end of next weekend.
So it's unfortunate for Duncan.
Yeah.
Which brings us to a completely unrelated story, which is somebody using the techniques... This is a Code Project article... using XNA-style techniques to build a WPF multiplayer game.
Right, and I was wondering why you would want to do this, actually, except if I've already got a WPF application that's doing like my accounting and payroll, and I wanted to add like a mini-game in there, then this is a really great approach for doing that without having to use some pesky game framework like XNA, right?
Pesky game
yeah,
framework.
Yeah, exactly. And I also love their UK spelling of four.
Waiting for players on your horrible.
Exactly. That's great.
So I really like this article. One, it gives you like the whole view of the map.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it gives you like, you know, the things that the server needs to worry about is based on the current position. What is the hit map, if you will? So like, what is the collision map?
Sure. And even more basic than that, you don't have a game loop with a framework like WPF.
Yeah, so it uses the on-render.
Yeah.
Instead of having, say, like controls of a button control, which is of another type of control, which is a templated control, which is mm-hmm. a framework element and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's cool.
And of course the multiplayer, and even knowing things like the Z order map. So it's like, okay, so a tree is at this Z order, the car is at this, so therefore we should show the tree, not the car.
Right.
So the car isn't driving on top of the tree.
Well, unless it's a hover car.
Are you saying they've implemented hover cars in WPF? Brian is going on record that...
I wasn't supposed to talk about that. That's in the next version.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. There goes our secrets.
Moving right along.
Moving right along to the WPF system-wide keyboard hook.
Yeah, this is one that, I've always really wondered how you can do this, but you can subscribe to basically any keyboard event that goes on, whether or not your WPF application has focus, and then you can do something based on that. So if I wanted to map Control Shift W so that the user pressed that, and then like how Snagit comes up and gives you the ability to grab a screenshot, this article describes exactly how to do that.
I'm using Greenshot now. Greenshot's my...
Greenshot, that's
right.
It's
free, yeah. So,
Or keyloggers, if you wanted to build a keylogger. I'm not saying you should, just saying you can.
Just... and now you have the code.
Yes.
But the point is, this is... it's actually, I think it was using some of the keyboard, C# keyboard hooking that Stephen Tobe did.
Oh, yeah. So, back when you used to do MSDN articles.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, cool stuff. Now, Dan Wallen talks about, and we've talked about Dan, he's been doing a lot of HTML JavaScript lately, and this is really talking about techniques for JavaScript code. So how do you structure JavaScript code? And the idea is to take, if you can see on the screen there, that calculator application. He walks through, the different ways to do it. You'd probably start off in a procedural way, where you do, there's an add function, a subtract function, multiply, divide. And he has a four-part series, actually, where he walks through, let's take the same scenario, building the calculator app, and show you different patterns for how to structure your code. So you can use prototypes and make them all sort of one and have its own constructor. And it's OO-style features in JavaScript that .NET developers would expect, but here's how you kind of use them with JavaScript, because since you don't have you don't have full OO.
That's awesome.
Or real OO.
So he's not talking about how you structure the libraries across multiple files or not, but he's really talking about how do you enable pseudo like inheritance and
it's either like you can keep things like straight up procedures, or you can do things where you're. It's just different ways to structure functions, code, and what's the logical grouping and different ways to do logical grouping for JavaScript code.
Got it.
So, cool stuff, which brings us to another one, JavaScript for .NET developers.
JavaScript for .NET developers. So, if you've been living in C# and VB and maybe J# for the last few years, and you're noticing that there's a lot of stuff that is kind of moving to the web and starting to support JavaScript, you may be wondering, how can I really dive in and come up to speed on JavaScript quickly? And so I like this set of resources because it's really targeted at us .NET developers and helping us come up to speed on everything that's going on kind of in the JavaScript world.
Yeah, so, besides book recommendations, some of the classic ones are W3 schools. Mm-hmm. And then specifically he goes into, his personal experience. And really one of the best tutorials I've seen is the jQuery for absolute beginners that he links to as well.
Nice.
So since a lot of people tend to use jQuery and really higher level frameworks, like you need to understand the basics of JavaScript. Mm-hmm. But jQuery is kind of like it's like the .NET framework, if you will.
Sure.
So, if you will.
If I will. I will. I'll humor
okay,
you.
Okay, and now you've heard it today. He will.
I will.
He will. Which brings us to LightSwitch.
Yeah, so in the spirit of shipping great training kits, DPE, in fact, our friend Robert Green, over from the Visual Studio Toolkit show, just shipped the RTM version of the LightSwitch training kit. And so this includes a number of hands-on labs and other samples that you can use to get started, not only learning how to use LightSwitch, but also how do you extend LightSwitch as well.
Sure.
So maybe you want to make available a component, like we were talking about the FedEx component last week, or maybe you've got an internal application and you want to make it easier for people within your organization to build their own custom apps as opposed to always coming to your group to say, hey, we need this slightly different app. You can build some components that make it easier for them to build those custom apps with LightSwitch.
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
A must-have, dare I say, for LightSwitch? People learning LightSwitch?
I will say, yes, you've heard it here first. It's a must-have.
Which brings us to Aryan Culp's Where's My Car application.
Yeah, well, go ahead and talk about this, and then I want to tell you a story that I had with another related type of application.
What's your story?
No, you go ahead and tell
us. I want to hear your story first.
No,
I will
you need
wait.
To set expectations.
Okay.
What is this application?
Damn it. This is an application, and it's really for your Windows phone. The idea is, you know, you go and park in a parking lot, and you're going to forget where you parked your car.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is you can actually, you know, take a picture or snap where the GPS is to know where your car is.
I used to text myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's very lonely.
Yeah.
Hi! What are you doing? That's so, so pathetic.
Yeah.
Dear
future self.
Now, this is rock bottom.
Yeah.
So where's my car part? Probably the coolest part is, one, everything's apps in the marketplace.
Yep.
Code's available as well, so if you want to learn what's going on.
Yep.
But one of the coolest parts, I think, is actually the implementation of routing. So the idea is you can actually since the map control that ships with Windows Phone doesn't include the ability to do, like, point A to point B, he actually calls the Virtual Earth service.
Mm.
He says that we're going to be using walking directions, because you can get driving or you can get walking. Ask for walking directions, and it'll give you a set of points, if you will, like turn right here, turn
yep.
right here.
Yep.
Those are all in latitude and longitude. You take that list, and then you build I think it's called a map polyline, and since you have the latitude and longitude, you take the map control and draw on top of the map and do a line yourself from point A to point B.
This is opposed to deep linking over to the actual map application and just passing in where you want to go. He chose to keep all this within the app as opposed to linking over to the built-in phone application.
Does the built-in phone app do turn by turn?
Yeah, it does. It does Well, not as you walk. Like I don't know if maybe this one updates as you walk. Here, you basically say, "Send me this from this location to this location," and it gives you a list of 15 steps. And as you complete those steps, it doesn't know that you're done with each one. I don't know if his does.
It will in Mango.
Oh yes, that's
it
right.
Will
you mentioned
in Mango
that a couple weeks ago.
But anyway, so the point is, there's a lot of fun stuff to play
so,
with.
So that's cool. So
tell me your story.
Before this was available, I found another one of these, like, hey, how do I remember where my car is parked? There's several in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to a party on Capitol Hill, and Capitol Hill, for those Seattleites, it's kind of a maze up there. There's
okay.
a lot of streets I'm
sure.
not familiar with. So
sure.
one street looks like the next. So I park my car, and I download this app, and I decide to try out the trial. The trial says it'll work for 1 hour. I assume that means 1 hour of actual runtime, meaning that, you know, I'm opening it for a few minutes and then I'm closing
hilarious.
It again. You can see where this is going. So the end of the party, you know, I'm wondering where my car is, and I go to run the app, and of course it's like 3 hours later, so it's expired. It won't let me find my car. And so now I'm faced with the decision of, like, wandering around Capitol Hill or, like, paying the $3.99. So basically, this is either the worst trial ever or the best trial ever. I ended up wandering around because, on principle, I didn't want to pay for this application. So I wandered around until I eventually found my car, like, half an hour later.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So that's my story.
That's kind of embarrassing.
It's kind of hilarious.
But not as embarrassing as texting yourself. So.
Yeah, that's right.
That's good stuff.
Yeah.
So kudos to Arian. So,
Picks of the Week.
Which brings us to Picks of the Week. And my Pick of the Week is our Faces of Microsoft campaign. So our Faces of Microsoft campaign was a bogus campaign. And the idea here was we'll bring in some people like Nick Fillingham's wife.
Yep.
Major Nelson.
Yep.
And a couple other people. And bring them in and tell them they're going to be part of a new campaign. We have this great, you know, a German photographer wants to take pictures and videotape the whole thing and just see how far they will go.
So this is kind of like punking them, right?
Yeah, so, and it's just really surprising how far people would go.
I love this screenshot, because I think at one time you had Larry Nelson on the floor, crawling around, meowing like a lion.
Or Major Nelson.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, he was
awesome.
Barking, he was,
wearing
a
pink boa or something.
He was pretending to be a connectimal, like, the whole thing. It's just, but this is what I'm saying, it's like, you know,
Now they're going to get you back, you know this. Right?
I think they're going to get Tina.
Oh, okay,
Which is another thing we got to mention, that Tina's now left her team.
That's right.
And she will be forever missed.
But she'll be making appearances on Channel 9 again.
Yeah, I think so. So she's not gone too far.
Yeah.
She's on the sister team.
So my Pick of the Week, this is a post that that Brian Harry made about some really cool changes that are happening in the next version of Team Foundation Server. So this is version control model enhancement. So in the past, anytime you wanted to make an edit to a file within Team Foundation Server 2010, for example, you had to check out that file. And then that would actually go to your local file system, and it would change the file from read-only to write-enabled, so you could make your changes. And Visual Studio basically had to tell TFS what changes you were making. And there's some perfectly good reasons for that in terms of scalability and large projects and everything else. But a lot of people are getting used to working with DBCS systems, and they also like occasionally working with files outside of Visual Studio as well. And so you don't want to have to remember, okay, I need to go in Visual Studio and mark these five files as checkout so that I can actually work on them. You just want to open them up in Notepad or Emacs or whatever, make the edits, and then when you're done, you can check them into TFS.
Yeah.
So that's now supported. Brian has all the details. I'm not going to get into everything here. Check out the video. Matt Mitrick put together a really nice video that goes into all the detail on this. But it's basically some really exciting changes that are coming.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, man. So that's our show, and thank you to everyone.